Nobody knows. Great. Okay. It's a cliche to say that people are not in need of introductions. Michael is certainly not in need of an introduction, but I'm going to give him an introduction anyway. Described by Gwyneth Lewis as a formidable poet, Michael has won numerous awards for his poetry and has translated more than 60 books from the German, among them works by W.G. Sebald, Goethe, and Rilke. Reading tours have taken Michael to Canada, the US and Mexico, Australia, New Zealand, India, and several European countries. His audience for his solo event at Adelaide Writers' Week 2012 numbered 700. His co-edited anthology, The 20th Century in Poetry, was a poetry bestseller, and his most recent collection of poems, A Half Life, was chosen as a Book of the Year by John Kinsella. He co-founded the Hippocrates Initiative for Poetry and Medicine with Professor Donald Singer in 2009. Michael has worked in publishing, television, and universities, and is now retiring from Warwick, where he has taught poetry and comparative literature for 18 years. And I'm quoting Michael here. In this event to mark his retirement, Michael will read from his poetry and translations and will spare us his wit and wisdom. Over to you, Michael.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to Chantal for hosting this and for those of you who are lurking unseen behind my screen. I'm going to look behind the screen, but I don't see you there. I'm imagining you're there. Can you all hear me okay? Yeah, I'm seeing some nods. Okay, good. I'm going to begin by reading a poem. I'm looking for it in the wrong book. That's not a good sign. A poem which ends up by remembering my father. My father was very important to me, and he spent some years after the Second World War in Singapore. And when I went to Southeast Asia for the first time in 1980, I knew that I would look for places that my father had known. But of course, I found myself thinking a lot of about empire and the end of empire, which has been an occasional subject in my poetry. Empire was obviously an ugliness as well as an absurdity. There is no way of taking from other people something for good without paying a price for it. And my father had witnessed many things at the end of empire, which sickened him profoundly, and he left me with a very deep aversion to everything of that sort. So when I went to Singapore, I treated myself and my partner to one night in the Raffles Hotel, which at that point had not undergone its very expensive remake of recent years. And after the experience, this poem emerge. Actually, this came out of a second visit, but that's more information than you need. Raffles Hotel. Say a colonial sailed up the straits and saw a fishing village and set foot in a city. Say the future was opium traded for tea, parades on the Padang, secret societies, rickshaws on Collyer Quay, and riots in the streets. Say an Armenian bought the villa where a bankrupt colonel had opened a tiffin parlor and made a white hotel, a place of colonnades and frangipani, palms, pilasters, rattan blinds, piano waltzes in the court, the marriage of the bride to the roué. And while men died at the Somme and at Passchendaele, a barman was gently shaking the first gin sling, while General Percival puffed and dallied, refusing to fortify Singapore on the landward side, the Japanese were riding down the peninsula on bikes. For history is a seduction, cocktails on the veranda, then dinner at 8, and the stylish contempt of the waiters. After the rain, the sky is open again, stars are holed in the indigo night. A British lord and lady lead their guests to a private banquet where pipers are playing Scotland the Brave. An Australian swears that the last tiger killed on the island was shot underneath the billiard table. This is the idiot empire, I'm lapping the pool past midnight, thinking of Dad, and the jazz bands playing in the bar. After the war, he dealt in textiles in Raffles Place, and one day his driver came early to warn him and hurry him to a villa where Englishmen waited, armed behind shutters, all the fanatical afternoon and night, making light of their fears, but whispering, watching, alert for a palm to sway as these do now, in the innocent air, trembling with the darker breathing of the saxophone. My father was very deeply aware of how very unpopular the British had made themselves after the eviction of the Japanese by returning in triumph as if nothing had happened and pretending that everything would carry on. And he lived there with deep affection for many of the people he met, but profoundly mixed feelings. He was a man who inhabited the past as well as the present very fully. And I want to move to a poem from a long set that I wrote after his death, in conversation with him, which comes out of his engagement with the Roman Empire. I remember that when I was small, my father's books were fascinating because there was so much history on his shelves, but there were all the books of contemporary life, memoirs of Sun Yat-sen, autobiography of Chiang Kai-shek, all these big events of the first 50, 60 years of the 20th century. He had studied closely the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. It all occupied him intensely. But he was steeped in the Roman Empire. There wasn't an inch of it that he couldn't talk about. I remember when later on I told him I was going to spend a month in Andalusia, he told me to go to Carmona, which I hadn't ever heard of. But it turned out that it was the only substantially extant Roman necropolis throughout anywhere touched by the empire. That just came instantly to his mind the moment I said Andalusia. Many, many things like that that I could tell you. When I was 11 years old, he took me walking for a week along Hadrian's Wall and took with him the 19th century handbook by Collingwood Bruce, which is still very, very much better than anything written since. And with its help, we found all sorts of things which were literally buried still, and which nowadays people look for in part with metal detectors, but some of them were untraceable with metal because we found things like slingshot. Here's an unexpected. Blown off the wall by Easter wind and rain, we're sheltering in the lee of a lonely farm. No other sign of comfort or of warmth in all Northumberland, for all I know. And you, with your nose in your precious book, ferreting out a passage again in your tattered Vade Mecum, the indispensable Collingwood Bruce, you tell me that 100 years ago the chives once planted by the legion stationed here at Walltown were growing in the grasses still, 16 centuries on. God knows I'm used to hearing things like this. My childhood has been spent in other ages, a game of hide and seek in ancient ruins. My family includes the Roman Empire. And so I'm unsurprised by what comes next. Chives, you announce, are indestructible. If they were here a century ago, they'll be here still. We only have to look. Of course, I look at the field and think you're mad. I'm soaked and cold, and all I see is grass. But no, you're a boy. A husband, father, man, but still a boy. Like me, your son. We're two boys together. And when at last, exulting and unchastened by the weather, we find the chives in the wild wet grass, And in my quickened mind, I see the Iberian legionnaire who planted herbs of home away from home. The world has undergone a change. To live in time is to grasp the hand of a man at work in a kitchen garden, a man long dead, but no more dead than you are dead today. One of my many boasts, because I'm a boastful character, is that I've twice struck lucky with the Bridport Prize for Poetry. I'm the only poet so far who's won it twice. And I started this reading with the first win, which was Raffles Hotel. And I'm going to read you the second poem that got that prize, because it picks up this motif of parents and children. For a long part of my life, in a succession of relationships that all seemed like the absolute perfect thing at the time, I was hoping that the moment would come when things would move in the direction of having children. And it never happened, and so I ended up becoming a father quite late in life. This is a poem which comes out of that midlife sense of wanting to have a child. Oddly enough, men can't do it by themselves. I call that a design flaw. And the wonderful partner I was with then was not yet ready, and in fact was suffering a very great deal herself from having had an abortion in her earlier life, which she regretted bitterly. And in her life since we separated, with other partners, she has had miscarriages. So she's had her own woes to bear. And this takes off from that lovely film of Charlie Chaplin's, which I'm guessing that some or all of you are familiar with, The Kid, the 1917 classic. The Kid. Remember seeing him interviewed on TV, that boy who played opposite Chaplin in The Kid? 60 years on, his eyes were dim. His meaty, carbuncular beat of a nose was pulsing with veins of imperial purple that looked like the terrible rubbery bits in liver that made your stomach heave when you were a kid yourself. Remember? We tried hard to see the child who had fathered the man, the scamp in the film, that six-year-old dodger who wore his artful innocence tipped at a streetwise angle, like his cap. No good. The child was gone. The boy we'd fallen in love with, who made us agree we'd like one, like him, ourselves, no longer existed, except on celluloid and in our heads. I thought of that day at the races in Kuching, the little Filipino girl you couldn't take your eyes off, wide awake, gamin, alive, a girl who could be your second self, or atone for your abortion. That, I suppose, must be what it comes down to. A kid is the road not taken, the self that has another chance and gets it all right. But no one could really conceive of that bleary pensioner on TV as a man who'd got anything right. The shock was mortal. Might we fail our own past? That kid who watched for the cop at a corner with Chaplin, that nipper who promised a life of vitality, humour and love, seemed terribly, simply by wearing his cap, a betrayal of all that might have been if the film had unreeled in ideal perfection. And suddenly, in the palace of silent movies, we saw the kids we'd been ourselves, surviving in gestures, jerking, dated, quaint. They never speak to us, those kids. They scarcely seem to know that we are what they have become. Always they're looking for someone else. And though they reach out, they can never hold our hand. I'm going to run with the theme of children for a moment, because as I said, I did finally get to experience the joys of being a father. And this poem, which sneaked into the very back of the 2009 book, The Secret History, was added at proof stage. It was written just 2 weeks before my daughter Agnes was born. And at that point, we knew her only from images on a screen. But this is the sort of welcome poem. And it's called To Our Unborn Daughter. It has an odd subtitle after Sophocles, because in the middle of it, there's an adaptation of that famous middle chorus from the Antigone about the Lord of creation and so on from a Greek perspective. And the thing that had struck me was that Robert Bringhurst, the wonderful Canadian poet and philosopher, he produced a glorious translation of that chorus, which imagined it to be ironic, because of course by now, when we have ourselves as the lords of creation and so on, it can only be an ironic thought given what we've done with this singular planet. And so so I've picked up his tone on that, but welcome the daughter, as it were, nevertheless. Daughter, this is a world of wonders, birdsong in an April dawn, sunlight in an orchard by a river, cherry blossom, summer rain, leaf smoke in October, snowfall, and the fragrances of apples, roses, rosemary, mown grass, wet earth, the taste of tiny forest strawberries. And one of the stranger wonders of all the world is humankind. Birds of the air, fish of the seas, horses, oxen, asses, goats, how their self-applauding Lord has used them. He's mapped shipping lanes on the oceans, drawn up agricultural plans, bred fellow beings to slaughter, and slaughtered his fellow beings. And then he's talked his sanctimonious stuff about saving the earth. Forgive humanity its vanity. If there's atonement and reparation, they lie in language, laws, in lucent water terraces of green made to reflect the heavens of Java, in the labor of love that makes a vineyard, a city, the thought of God, in the carvings of nameless artists at Urnes and Chartres, in the music of Beethoven, poems of Wordsworth and Rilke, in the touch that was brought to the marble and wood by the hand of Michelangelo, of Riemenschneider, in the love that was in the looking in the paintings of Vermeer. These, though not ours to give, are yours to inherit. Welcome, dear soul. The radiance that lights your mother's face is the same that you know from your home. Daughter, now come to our door. I'm just going to take a little detour, because I thought I would include a translated text. And this is also one that comes out of childhood. Those of you who were thinking that I might choose to read a passage from Sebert in this little reading are about to be disappointed, because it's in fact a passage from Rilke's novel, or better, I should say, anti-novel, The Notebooks of Malte Lauritz Brigge. And it's, if any of you have read this book, you'll know very, very well that it's impossible to call it anything resembling a narrative. The moment two or three pages generate that sort of sensation, it will break off and move to something entirely different. So calling it the notebooks of Matelao Itzbühel makes perfect sense. It reads like notebooks. And but I'm going to read a bit that does actually feature Malte, him of the title, and he is a boy. And in this little scene, he's to be imagined on a chair at a table drawing, and he drops one of his crayons under the table, and a governess or nurse, Mademoiselle, is sitting reading in the pool of lamplight in a corner, but underneath the table it's dark. So now I needed it once again, the crayon, but it rolled. I still see it right across the brightened page to the edge and fell down past me before I could stop it and was gone. I really did need it urgently, and having to climb down after it was distinctly vexing. Awkward as I was, it was quite a business to get down. My legs seemed far too long, and I couldn't draw them out from under me. Remaining too long in a kneeling position had numbed my limbs. I could not tell what was mine and what was the chair's. At length, rather at sixes and sevens, I did make it to the floor and found myself on an animal fell that extended under the table to the wall. But at this point, I was confronted with a fresh difficulty. My eyes, accustomed to the brightness above, and still wholly entranced by the colours on the white paper, were unable to make out anything at all below the table, where the blackness seemed so dense that I was afraid of knocking against it. So I fell back on my sense of touch, and kneeling and supporting myself on my left hand, combed through the cool, long-haired, familiar-feeling fell with my other hand. But there was no sign of the crayon. I felt I was wasting a good deal of time. I was about to call Mademoiselle and ask her to hold the lamp for me when I realized that as my eyes strained involuntarily, the dark was gradually growing more penetrable. Already I could distinguish the wall at the back, at the foot of which a light-colored skirting board ran. I took my bearings from the table legs, and in particular made out my own outspread hand, moving all alone down below, a little like some aquatic animal exploring the seabed. I still recall that I watched it almost with curiosity, as it groped about down there with a mind of its own, moving in ways I had never seen it move. It seemed able to do things I had not taught it. I observed it as it pushed onwards. I was interested and prepared for anything. But how could I have expected another hand suddenly to come towards it from the wall, a larger and unusually thin hand, such as I had never seen before? It was searching in similar fashion from the other side, and the two outspread hands moved blindly towards each other. My curiosity was not yet satisfied, but all at once it was at an end, and all that remained in its place was horror. I sensed that one of the hands belonged to me, and that it was about to enter into something that could never be righted again. Asserting all the rights I had over it, I stopped it and withdrew it, slowly and held flat, never taking my eyes off the other hand as it continued to search. I realized it would not abandon the search. I cannot say how I got up again. I sat back deep down in the armchair, my teeth chattering, and so little blood in my face that I felt there could not be any blue left in my eyes. Mademoiselle, I tried to say, and found myself unable to. She was alarmed without my alerting her, and throwing aside her book, knelt beside the armchair, called out my name, and I think may have shaken me. But I was perfectly conscious. I swallowed a couple of times, for now I wanted to tell her. But how? I made an indescribable effort to pull myself together, but it could not be expressed so that someone else would understand. If there were words for what had happened, I was too small to find them. And suddenly I was gripped by the fear that they might all at once be there, those words, in spite of my age. And the most terrible thing of all seemed to me that I would then have to utter them, to have to relive that reality down there once more, with a difference, transmuted from the very beginning, to hear myself admitting it, I did not have the strength left for that. The more there are one or two passages in that very strange book which have an autonomous life online, because it appears there are people who think of this as the book with the strange ghosts in it, just as there are all sorts of weirdo communities on the net. And obviously that is a reading of that passage, but the more I've lived with it, the more I've thought that that is one of Rilke's great sustained metaphors for the act of writing and its relationship to the imagination. A terrific passage. I took the name of the great and dearly lamented Max Sebald in vain a minute or so ago. I've been enormously fortunate because I've been able to have friendships with a number of writers for whom I had enormous respect. And Max, I knew not at all as well as some others. I would like to mention Alan Kernow, for example, the great New Zealand poet, or Robert Gray, the great Australian poet, who is happily still alive. And numerous others that I could mention. Rather than just drop the names, let me just say that this is, in my experience, one of the great things of moving into writing, because when you come to kindred spirits and a friendship evolves, it turns out to be one of the greatest experiences of your life. And so I've been very fortunate. I am going to read a poem that I did write in memory of Max Sebald, and it took me a long time to write this, about 8 years later after his death, simply because I couldn't think of a good way to write it. And in any case, there was a certain fear of being cheesy and all that sort of stuff. And then I happened, for whatever reason, to be reading the journals of Sepharis. And the passages immediately put me in mind of Max. And I thought of his glorious habit of writing about his deep preoccupations by borrowing stories of other people's lives and writing about those, or the material that others have done, and transforming it, transfiguring it. So I thought that I would say farewell to Max by using a lot of Sepharis' materials out of his journals. And this is what came out. Because Sepharis was returning to the Ionian coastline where he grew up, I borrowed one of Max's section titles, Il Ritorno in Patria, for the poem. Returning to the Ionian town of his birth, Sepharis found the windows of his childhood home were broken. The iron door was rusted. The shutters of the upper story rotted. He was unable to find his initials, which he had carved on a wall when he was 10. The wheel well still drew water. A tiny donkey turned it, and a mulberry gave shade. But the old plane tree had died that bustled with sparrows in the afternoons. Of the 10 windmills that bristled on the hills behind the harbour, all that remained were a handful of ruins. Smyrna, he wrote in his journal, had lost its shadow. At Ephesus, the cyclamen wore tones of the Ionian sky. What was the harbour was sunken now, dry ground, the mouth of the tomb of a once great city and its dead surrounding plain. This was the conductor of the souls of the vanished harbours of Asia Minor. For the moment, he wrote, there is consolation in twilight on the slopes of Ionia, the cyclamen, in which one may sense the tremors of the great soul of Heraclitus. So I've touched on translation. All of my translating life, I've courted ill favor by insisting that it is, in spite of everything, a secondary function. That is my conviction. I don't mean it's a function to be held in any lower respect. Everybody knows the intelligence and sensitivity and resourcefulness that has to go into a decent translation. But the fact is that, as with criticism, it does not happen unless there is a prior existing text that somebody else has made. That is, to my mind, a secondary relationship. I enjoy doing translation enormously. There have been one or two translations that I detested, but that's another question. But nevertheless, it is a very different sensation from having to find something of any sort of interest to fill a page with that is completely blank and where nobody has done any work for you at all before. Now, one of the offshoots of being a translator is that, if you like, you can go and spend pretty much as long as you want in a pretty nice establishment known as the European Translators College, in a small town in Germany on the border with the Netherlands. I did that at one point for about 3 weeks, and the poem I'm going to read is one of two that came out of that. It's called Quod Scripsi Scripsi, which you'll recognize as, I can see a smile on Tim Leach's face. Thank you for getting that, Tim. Those are the words of Pontius Pilate, of course. So when you get to the expression autopilot later in the poem, imagine it's spelt that way, not P-I-L-O-T. For those of you who are really seriously sad cases, such as me, you may find some sport in listening for the trochaic octameter in the poem. There is one. Nobody writes trochaic octameters. And needless to say, it's about the function of language to become autonomous and to find its own way and do things. Quod scripsi scripsi. All these dictionaries, in passageways, the TV room, everywhere, anywhere you might suddenly need to know the something else for something. Serbian Icelandic, Spanish Croat, English Thai, Tibetan German. So many beautiful flurries and blizzards and sandstorms of words. So many weatherly ways of getting lost in the world. So many withering seductions. Lingua's a woman, of course. Of course, she has a way of wearing high heels for a trek through the veldt. She says, did you bring a map? It's hot. She hitches her blouse up and knots it. Now her ice cream starts to drip. She sucks her thumb. Don't get ideas. These are just words. This is language writing the poem on autopilot, jesting, playing with itself, washing its hands, and idling, ticking over, doing nothing, thinking nothing, finding mischief, as it always does for idle words to do. What I have written, the language has written for me. Whenever I think of those words, quad scripsi scripsi, they inevitably bring Alan Kernow to mind. He was not simply a great poet and to me a great friend, but also somebody who in his early life had almost chosen to go through with taking holy orders and becoming an Anglican priest like his father before him. He didn't do that. He became a journalist and later a university academic. But his deep involvement with religion and philosophy was a constant in his life, a very rich, honest doubter to the very end. And whenever I think of those words, it reminds me of the Melbourne magazine, Scripsi, which was in the 80s and 90s till it closed, by a long way one of the finest literary magazines in the English-speaking world. And Alan astonished me on one occasion by saying that he absolutely refused to read it. And baffled, I said, "Why would you do that?" And he said, "Because of their choice of title." He'd actually written to them to suggest they might prefer to use a different title. That was very much the kind of attention that he would choose to bring to a word. But I want to read just a little poem, because it's so difficult to write poems which are simply celebratory or poems of friendship. And this was a poem which I called To Alan Kernow. And it just goes like this. Late light on the lake, and the ferry's wake is filled with a silver shiver. Yes, the world can end any time it likes, and that will be all, I suppose. But first, you'll pull at your pipe and tell another story, happily, wrinkling your eyes in concentrated quiet, and crinkling your contented face like the man who has drawn out Leviathan. Your talking is like walking with a friend in gentle country, where at last, beyond a rough stone wall, we come upon the sea. But when you write, you trust to the great water and take your passage on the ferry's element as if the open white of a wake need never close again. I've got a little list of things here that I planned to read, and I've only got three more items on the list. So it looks to me as if we have 10 minutes to go, and that will leave you a little window for all those questions that I can't answer. So I've been lucky in many ways. Some of this luck, I'm guessing, doesn't end with retirement from a university, because I mentioned, for example, William Golding and Alan Kernow. I met them in 1985 at the Festival of Authors in Toronto at Harbourfront. And that was the beginning of a period of, 20-odd years when I was quite regularly on the circuit, as they call it. It hasn't quite dried up, because in the last 10 years, people have had me over to Mexico, Australia, the US, New Zealand. So it still happens now and then. I hope it doesn't happen too much, because with my hips in their present condition, I don't want any more long-haul flights. Thank you for the invitation, nevertheless. But those invitations to do interesting things in interesting places were always a tremendous bonus that you never ever imagine will come your way when you first start writing poems. One of the bonuses was a little project that ended up running for 4 years in Ethiopia. It began in 1999, And that was the 250th anniversary of the birth of Goethe. And all of the Goethe institutes around the world were finding ways of celebrating Goethe, especially that year. And unfortunately, the Goethe Institute in Addis Ababa was having a really hard time finding somebody from Germany who was willing to go to Addis Ababa and speak in English, because nobody there understood the German at the university or among the writers that they were up into a group. So they asked me, and off I went. And because the first year went well enough, they asked me back to not just work on Goethe's poems with a group of writers and academics, but on poems by other writers. The result of all those labors in those 2 years was the first ever anthology of German poetry in Amharic translation. It's not something I expect to appear in large letters on my gravestone, but nevertheless, it was fun to do it. And for another 2 years after that, we did translations of German prose together. It was huge fun, and I learned an awful lot. The reason all of that is coming to my mind, I could tell some very amusing stories about all of that if you wanted, but instead of that, I'm going to read another poem, which is what you probably don't want. But anyway, this poem here, which is called Wevelsfleet, is connected because the nice woman who ran the Goethe Institute when I first went in 1999 retired a couple of years later and bought from Günter Grass the house that he used to live in a little village called Wevelsfleet, north of Hamburg, on the banks of the Elbe. And she and her partner still live there. They're still good friends. And this poem, which I think of as a poem about my deep political convictions, because I suppose I've always been a man of the moral left, not necessarily a donkey jacket party man, but somebody who has deep aversions to the fixation on money and ownership and all of those things that become part of power and so on. But this came out of a visit to Wevelsfleet, and that is its title. It is the sort of North European village where storks from Spain or Morocco might spend the summer, and writers might settle to savor the bracing quiet. Did anyone ever grow wealthy in this place? The fishermen's crofts along the dikes are simple homes, and those who have lived in the farmsteads that stand like stranded hay wains stuck at the ends of lanes of pollard willows won't ever have made much more from the land than the wittering sheep that crop the grass. It's the fourth largest in the world, says our friend, as we walk to the deep water fleet that flows into the Elbe, the fleet from which the village takes its name. He means the enormous yacht that is under construction in the dock. It is three times the height of any building anywhere in sight. I'd pictured something 40 feet long with sails, but this is the size of a North Sea ferry plying out of Hamburg. The American who thought he wanted it tired of it quickly and sold it on to a sheikh. The sheikh had marble flooring laid throughout. It added tons to the displacement. When he got rid of it, the present owner, another billionaire, had all the marble ripped right out again. Might as well burn your millions. Still, it means jobs. An army of hard-hatted fitters and welders, engineers with clipboards, men in overalls or suits, are swarming under the cantilevered gantry of a crane. That camp of cabins has doubled the population. Watch for the number plates. Spanish, Polish, everybody's here. We walk on past the dock to where the fleet flows into the Elbe. The muscled waters gather, strong and confident and old. The river writes no chronicles, affords no consolation. It has only the beauty and might of a natural thing. No more, no less. The tree line on the farther bank a half-hour ferry ride away, is fading into April warmth and haze, where light and land and water meet and marry. Nothing I see, I own, and nothing would I wish to own. I'll read a poem which, in a funny sort of way, came out of another part of my professional life, because as Chantal said at the beginning, I've been at Warwick University for 18 years. It's the longest I've ever been in the employ of any one employer. Hello? Can somebody give me a sign of life? Because my screen looks as if it's frozen.
Can still hear you, Michael.
Oh, that's grand. Your picture's frozen and so has Tim's, Tim Leach's, and that was why I was asking. Thank you very much, Chantal, I'm reassured. Anyway, so one of the things I did before I came to Warwick, I was a freelance for a bit longer and used to do a lot of adapting programs for Deutsche Welle television programs, TV programs that have been made in German and needed to be re-scripted for English resynchronization. And one of these most extraordinarily lovely programs was about the last pigment mill in the whole of Europe that produces the lapis lazuli based blue pigment that Fra Angelico used in his paintings. So restorers of Fra Angelico's can only get their pigment from this mill. It's somewhere near Augsburg. And so for the duration of my work on that program, I was just steeped in all the language of rare pigments and so on. But what came out, I think, is more than a poem about that. It's more than just a recipe for how to make the blue pigment as well. I think of this as a kind of almost a manifesto, I suppose. It's called Caput Mortuum. An apple orchard, meadows and a river, a raft at a mooring where children are swimming, an ancient ash, the sawmill and the bridge, and at the heart, the home of all our colours, tin pails of white lead paste and silver mica from China, and zinc oxide from Peru, Carrara dust, Pozzuoli, burnt sienna, red ochre, aniline, Verona green, damar resin, madder lake, campeachy, bone black, indigo and dragon's blood, Dutch pink and gallnuts, dried black mallow flowers, camala, berberis root and walnut shells, and dark in the stillness, a man with a mortar and pestle, cracking the lapis lazuli apart, grinding the purest in the pulverisette, second grinding, then a sifting, binding the powder with turpentine resin and heated beeswax, letting it draw for a day, then straining it in a linen bag in a bucket of lukewarm water, colour coming in a tide, filling 50 pails, returning to the first to pour the water off and dry the sediment and sift again. This, I think, as I gaze beyond the river where the children swim, beyond to where the sky consoles with old familiar colours of our physics and our souls. This, in our stillness, is our purest blue. I shall come to an end with a poem from the book, which is still not quite finished. It's a poem very much to do with my daughter. She's now 11. This was written when she was 8. We first went to Venice when she was just 4 years old. and we've been back a couple of times since then. And she understands more about Venice every time. But the thing that she couldn't do when she was 8 years old was to pronounce the name of the church, the Frari. She was always saying the Ferrari. And the Ferrari was comical to us because my daughter and I had discovered Top Gear. I mean, I've oddly enough, for someone who worked in television, I've never been much of a watcher of television. And until I watched Top Gear, the old ones, with my daughter, I'd never ever seen them. But I knew, of course, of Jeremy Clarkson by his dubious reputation. But we watched them together and laughed ourselves silly. It's a great thing for a parent and child to do together. And so that's why they make a strange appearance in this poem. Otherwise, I think everything in it speaks for itself. And this will be my last one. And I suppose that, like the Caput Mortuum poem, this one, along with the other one, are a sort of a message to everyone as we go forward into what's ahead. The Ferrari. Here is the church, and here the reflective water, and there is the bridge we cross, and 50 paces take us to the workshop where my daughter could happily watch all day as cats of glass and elephants and seagulls and flamingos come to their being in the making flame. This is the church where Monteverdi lies, the church where my daughter is careful to step on the rose-coloured flagstones only, the church she infallibly calls the Ferrari, where dwell, we say, the Trinity of Richard, James and Jeremy. And over there's the workshop, where my daughter watches the flame of the gas jet on the glass, watches the flare of the flame transfer a glow and sinew to the tractable matter, watches a droplet dabbed and worked and stretched until it lifts its head and is a swan. All over the city, the boats unload their made-in-China boxes, and the shops that sell the glass no craftsman ever worked are selling the soul of the city. And this my little daughter understands, and in that understanding I rejoice. The craftsman is an unpretentious sort, whistling at his work to country songs, discarding broken or misshapen pieces with a lack of fuss that can be learnt as well, just as one learns a lack of self-importance. 34 years he's worked in this one shop. My daughter first came here when she was 4, then 6, now 8, tradition in the making. Some things she sees are worth far more than money. Venetian glass and mirrors, Trilling tells us, were crucial to the growing sense of self. She'll read it one day, but she knows it now. It's 5, and past the church of the Ferrari, shop girls and office workers head for their trains. They can't afford apartments anymore that sell for silly sums to foreign owners. You absolutely have to come and stay. The people of the city live in Mestre. My understanding daughter lit a candle. Together in the church we said a prayer. But now I think we should have said another. For a world that values birthright over greed, a world that wants its beauty to be true. Daughter, that is the world I wish for you. I can see but not hear.
thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you very much indeed. And the one thing I haven't said yet is that it is quite a moment to be I'm thanking somebody who just sent a message in. I still haven't got the knack of reading things at the same time as I'm looking and speaking. But anyway, it's been grand to have good students and good colleagues, and Warwick has been a goodly employer, and it's There are things that nobody will miss when they leave institutions. Nobody misses the bureaucrats and technocrats who make our lives so much easier, as they will tell us. But there is much else to miss. Thank you, Tim, for laughing at all the right places.
Absolutely. I mean, I just wanted to say thank you, Michael. I'm in the position, the unusual position, to be able to thank you from both sides of the aisle. I was taught by Michael when I was a tiny undergrad, and I work alongside him. So thank you for both for being an excellent teacher and a wonderful colleague.
Thank you very much. Can I hire you to write my obituary, if ever there is one? Not that I expect to die. Not planning it.
Thank you, Michael. I really loved hearing, especially those last two poems and the translation of Malte Lorenz Brega, which is such an extraordinary book. And I've always thought that passage was his, it was almost like this Sartre-esque description of the two hands, you know, from the two halves of the self or something, but the translation really brought that across well, I thought. But, you know, I just would say, now that I'm in your office over in humanities, you know, it's a rather large shoes to fill. So anyways, it's great to hear you read.
It was a great office. I'd forgotten you're in that, you bastard.
I am, yeah. it is a good office, except for all the students congregating outside the door, you know, while they wait for class, but.
Are you enjoying the view over Car Park 8?
Yeah, it's beautiful with the fringed with autumn, fringed with autumn colors. Yeah, it's great.
There you go. Yeah.
Michael, are you still able to hear me? My screen is completely frozen, but I can hear everybody.
We can
hear you.
That's
fine. I can hear you. Yes, I can. Thank you.
Okay, I have no control over any of the controls anymore. Nothing is working, but at least the sound is coming through. I don't know if we have Ian, who wanted to say a few words. I know he's had difficulty connecting. Ian, I don't know if you want to come in.
I hope I might finally work. I'm on my phone, if you can hear me.
I can hear you.
Well, Michael, I just wanted to say, Michael, on behalf of all of us in the WWP, I'm so glad that you did not spare us your wit and wisdom, as well as your poetry there, because we do need it and we do appreciate it. And we have appreciated you. All of us who've worked with you have appreciated so much. You're a man of deep, deep culture, as those poems about family and friends have shown us. And we're really going to miss you. You made a tremendous contribution. It's clear you're talking about your extraordinary career. You have a surfeit of brilliance and a heart of gold. And we just want to say thank you very much, everyone who's worked with you over the years. And my favorite poem of yours, Michael, which you didn't read, was, or one of them is from Half Life, which is, I can't read, is it called The Return or Return? In which you talk about the soul's dwelling in a place, and your spirit will certainly inhabit the Warwick writing program for many years to come. So thank you so much on behalf of all of us. I think Chantal and Maureen were going to say a few words as well, so I'll hand over to them.
Thank you, Ian. That was very, very kindly put. Thank you very much.
I can just pop in just to say, I mean, having co-marked with Michael quite a bit, you know, assessments, and also worked with students who've been in his reading and writing module. I mean, really, what an extraordinary teacher you have been. That's clear to me. Students have shown their appreciation, and you know, making anthologies of works that they produced for your workshop in my small press publishing. So, you know, the echo on. For sure.
Very kind of you, Jonathan. Thank you. Very kind of you.
Michael, if you can still hear me, I may be dwelling in this Blackboard session forever because my entire laptop has frozen, but I can still hear everybody.
Okay, and I can still hear you. Listen, I think we will end this fairly punctually, not least since that gives me a short break before I start an online class at 14:45. But I thought that the way to end this might be if I tell you one of the lovely moments from Ethiopia. May I do that? Is that okay with everybody?
Please do.
Okay, thank you. It's a translation moment. The thing is, I was working with some stupendous people. Some of them were writers, not particularly poets. There were mostly playwrights and novelists in the group. Others were academics from the University of Addis Ababa. And none of them knew any German. I knew no Amharic, so everything went through the middleman of English. And in the second year that I was there, we were trying to write an Amharic version of Hölderlin's poem, Hälfte des Lebens. And this is a poem which includes in it, for those who don't know it, it includes a swan and, what was the other thing? And pears, swan and pears. There are no words in Amharic for either of these things. In the dictionary, if they look up swan, it says a kind of waterfowl, but there is no word for it. And similarly with the fruit. So they wanted me to explain all about these things. And I ended up giving them a sort of potted lecture. I still hear myself in my nightmares talking for about 15 minutes about the cultural status of the swan in Europe. And everything was in there from Leda and the swan right through to the adornments of helmets of the Knights Templar and the Teutonic Knights and so on. Everything that I could think of to do with swans. It was the most extraordinary thing. They listened with extraordinary reverence and attention. And at the very end of it, one of them said, well, in that case, can we put duck? And for those of you who know the poem, you'll realize that that just won't cut it. That won't cut it. Lots of moments like that. With the swan, they put flamingo in the end. And with the pear, they ended up choosing to put a mango in. So it was obviously suddenly the poem had become located in a place that Hölderlin had certainly never visited.
I'm wondering if you can hear me, Michael?
I can hear you, Maureen.
I think this is a moment for me to thank you for what you taught me about translation through your example, which is why I do not think of your translations as secondary in any way. I've particularly inspired by the collaboration you had with the Turkish poet Cevat Çapan and the way you worked together over many years, I think, a friendship between two poets. And the proof of the friendship isn't on the page. Everything I aspire to do as a translator comes out of having witnessed that wonderful friendship on the page. So I think you talk yourself down, but I'll let you do that. But I wanted to thank you as well.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. That means a lot.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
It's often surprising to think of the gap between one's own experience. I mean, I always think of literary making as a kind of a pyramid, and the ones that get remembered and seminars are taught about them and so on are the little pinnacle at the top. And I picture myself as somewhere quite near the bottom, but there has to be a fundament, there has to be a base, otherwise the thing falls down. So I don't think it's a worthless thing to have done in one's life. There we are. But it's nice to know. It's nice to know that occasionally an acorn starts to grow.
Michael, thank you so much for reading so beautifully. We're mindful that you have to go and teach. I just have, I'll finish with two lines from your and my old friend Rilke, just to bring this to a close. And it will be in German, everybody. Please forgive me for this. Bear with me. It's from Rilke's letter to Kappus of the 12th of August, 1904. Wie man sich lange über die Bewegung der Sonne getäuscht hat, so täuscht man sich immer noch über die Bewegung des Kommenden. Die Zukunft steht fest, liebe Michal. Wir aber bewegen uns im unendlichen Räume. Thank you very much, Michal. Best wishes for your retirement. We're sorry that we couldn't do this in a better way because of the pandemic, but we're glad that we were able to at least have this virtual farewell today.
Well, this was very pleasant and affecting. Thank you so much. It's touched me. And I'll just reply with the last line of the 8th elegy. So leben wir und nehmen immer Abschied.
Lovely. Yeah. Thank you, Michal.
Bye-bye, friends.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, Michal.
Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Michal. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Oops.